From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about a proposal to make some big updates to the state's biking and walking trails. Then we'll help you plan a trip to Cave of the Mounds.
They'll see wonderful crystal formations that are made drip by drip over hundreds of thousands of years. There's underground streams, and we even have a giant cephalopod fossil.
Plus, Bubbler Talk explores a mysterious set of numbers and dates inlaid in the sidewalk outside of the Mitchell Park domes.
All of these are exactly where they need to be according to the calculations. So we stand here and we're going to pretend this is a beautiful sunny day.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Biking advocates are hoping to see a big financial boost for developing trails in Wisconsin. That's due to Governor Tony Evers' proposed two-year state budget, which recommends spending more than $18 million a year on trails. Most of that would be new money from the federal government. Brian Hausch of the Rails to Trails Conservancy joins WUWM's Chuck Kornbach to explain what this money could be used for.
Maybe some of the top line things that are exciting for biking and walking advocates are, first of all, allocating more of, as you referred to, those federal dollars that come from the Transportation Alternatives Program. And with the new bipartisan infrastructure law, Wisconsin gets about $30.5 million in federal dollars that are really designed for trails, walking, and biking. Before that, it was about $17.5 million. So the new federal dollar increase was about 70%. And in the past, Wisconsin has dedicated about $7 million of those federal dollars to trails. And we're really excited to see a proposal to dedicate more than $18 million a year.
Okay, and what else might you really like in the governor's budget?
The other two things we're excited about is the proposal to set aside $1.2 million for the matching component of transportation alternatives, which is set at 20% of a project's cost. And this is specifically focused on small communities of 5,000 or less. The last thing that I'll highlight, but there are many other great things in the budget, is a one-time $60 million for traffic calming projects. So things like more stoplights and other signage in places where young children and all folks are crossing the road, the islands that can slow down traffic, bump outs where the crossing across the road is quite lengthy. And we think that's really important because it's a nice complement to building more trails and sidewalks and so forth.
In the Milwaukee area, we have the Hank Aaron State Trail and the Oak Leaf biking trails in Milwaukee County. What more might be in the Evers proposal in the way of additional trails? What more could we see within the next few years if this budget proposal goes through?
Yeah, well, I would say, that $18 million really responds to the fact that the Transportation Alternatives Program is typically oversubscribed by three times or more. So there are lots of projects on the table. In the Milwaukee area, one of the really exciting projects is what we call the Route of the Badger. And it is connecting up existing trails and building more trails across seven counties. And when it's completed, it would be more than 700 miles of paved trails that are connected in that area. And related to that, there are two components that are really important. One of them is the 30th Street Corridor, which really gets at some of the equity issues around trails being able to connect communities and bring more opportunities. And, that's a community that was divided by the highway. And, giving people safe places to walk and bike is really important. Another component of Route of the Badger is the White River State Trail, which is in Racine. And that's a really nice aspect of a more rural community that could really benefit from bringing visitors and also providing residents with opportunities to bike and walk to the places that they want to get to.
Right, in the Union Grove and Burlington area, I've reported on some of that, and they are trying to advance a proposal down there. So your coalition met with state lawmakers in Madison. How did your advocacy work go? Are you encouraged, or did you get a lot of doors, maybe not slammed, but at least closed to you?
You know, it was a great day, and we had over 50 advocates from all across the state. So we were able to meet with almost every legislator or their legislative aide. And whenever I've advocated at the state capitol, I always hear from legislators how excited they are to talk about trails. And, you know, I think there's a recognition that, you know, very bipartisan or nonpartisan, that trails and walking and biking infrastructure are good for communities. They're great investments. They, you know, make for thriving, healthy communities, and really just bring a lot of other, you know, health, safety, recreational benefits that are really appreciated. And so, you know, in my job as the policy manager for, you know, Rails to Trails, it's really nice to not be dealing with very contentious issues and to have real conversations about those opportunities.
Still, some conservative Republican legislative leaders have been warning there are a lot of things they don't like in the governor's budget proposal, that there are a lot of requests for money out there, that the surplus the state believes it has is maybe not that long lasting or as strong as some have thought. So what do you say to people who say, well, I like bike trails, but we can't fund everything?
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of times whenever I do hear a little bit of pushback, it's the idea that trails are recreation and that we got to look at more important things. But the reality is, investments in walking and biking infrastructure are smart investments that bring a lot of economic value. And we've done some studies for Wisconsin that have highlighted that with both direct spending and health cost savings, we look at over $1.5 billion that trails bring to the Badger State. So I think that's really important. And then, you know, specifically on this top ask around allocating more of those federal dollars to trails, it's a no-brainer because the new bipartisan infrastructure law does not allow for diverting those funds. So while the former money that we mentioned, the $17.5 million, up to half of that can be diverted to highway projects, the additional 70% that's been increased, it's restricted for that diversion. So this is a really easy thing for all legislators to agree to because those dollars are designed for walking and biking infrastructure, and it's now really clear that they need to be dedicated in that way.
So if a lawmaker says, well, I would really prefer more potholes fixed on State Highway 26, some of this budget proposal can't be used for that.
Yeah, that new $13 million-ish that's been added to Wisconsin's allocation cannot. So, you know, you add 13 to the $7 million, you got $20 million to invest in trails.
And there was also news from the federal government, again, on the next year's budget proposal from President Biden, a budget proposal which may change a lot, but I think your coalition saw some encouraging signs there as well. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, this has been a great administration for supporting, you know, a lot of the bicycle pedestrian activities with a real focus on safety. And we are very encouraged with the federal grant opportunities that go beyond transportation alternatives. And I mean, these are the kinds of investments that are so transformative. I mean, we saw it during the pandemic, how people were looking for safe places to recreate. But we also, you know, think about it in terms of that active transportation piece and the fact that a lot of people can't afford a car, can't drive a car. And so giving folks access to, you know, all those critical services and their jobs and education is really important as well.
You sound encouraged at this moment, crossing your fingers as you talk to me.
Yeah, you know, I feel really positive. It's always challenging to get the money flowing where it should go. But, you know, we're seeing good things across the Midwest and really across the country. And that's part of, I think, how we make the case is look what these other states are doing. And I think that's really compelling to our Wisconsin legislators as well.
Brian Hausch is the Midwest Policy Manager at the Rails to Trails Conservancy. He spoke to WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. Formerly incarcerated people face a lot of obstacles when re-entering our community. They're cut off from a lot of jobs and educational opportunities, making it difficult to find steady employment and create a new life post-conviction. A program through Education Trust is trying to change the legal landscape to open new opportunities for these people. It's called the Justice Fellows Policy Program, and Milwaukeean Shannon Ross was a part of their inaugural group of fellows. He continues to be a part of the program, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about how this project has helped his work as the executive director of the community, a local organization that helps people leaving incarceration.
So tell me a bit about this program that you're now involved with. What is the Justice Fellows Policy Program?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you said the title because I actually don't even know the extensive title of it. But I know the program, of course, because I'm in it. And it's a second year of a fellowship that EdTrust, an organization in D.C., has put on. EdTrust, as I am learning more about them, is pretty significantly involved in higher education, lobbying, advocacy across the country. And they just do a lot around policy and advocacy to improve education and all like the aspects of education, not just education in general, but, you know, certain data and a lot of changes for specifically marginalized populations to have better access and better quality of education. And so it just makes sense that they started a fellowship for individuals that are system impacted is the general term that's used, which just means a person that is formerly or currently incarcerated, or in this case, formerly, they don't have anyone that's currently incarcerated, or loved ones. And I think for us, we have to have been impacted by the system by way of having been charged and done time, or at least, you know, having been charged and gone through the probation aspect of it, maybe not necessarily in prison. And we this year are doing something different than the cohort last year. Last year, the cohort was designed, the entire point of it was designed to help implement or get Pell reinstated for everyone across the country that is currently incarcerated. That was taken away in 1994. There's a long backstory of how it got to that point. And leading up to next year, there has been a period of time where the what's known as Second Chance Pell was implemented that Obama signed back in, I think, the last year of his tenure. And that allowed a certain number of schools across the country to have access to Pell dollars to offer higher education in whatever form each state decided that would be to incarcerated individuals.
What is the program in Wisconsin?
So the program in Wisconsin had been through MATC exclusively. And there were certain tiers. There was like second or third implementation of Second Chance Pell. And a lot of this gets kind of in the weeds and some of the terminology for it. But just what it meant that from the very beginning of Second Chance Pell, which again started in Obama's last year, to I think this year is the very last year Second Chance Pell will be applicable, because after this year, Pell is across the board available to everybody that is incarcerated. And Pell just refers to that money that's available to college students. Again, that was taken away from people that were incarcerated in 94, but it's always been available to students across the country. If you you know, have financial difficulties and you can get money from the federal government for that, it's probably the most well-known money you can get. And so MATC ran that through the DOC. It started in about 2017. I was the very first person in Wisconsin to graduate under that program with a huge, huge caveat. I only needed one class when they started. I had already been taking my correspondence courses for my degree, which ended up seeing through 9 different schools, I think, over the course of 11 years. So now going forward, I will be able to have that for everybody in the prison system. And they're just working out how that's going to operate. But that was the initial intent of the first cohort last year for the Ed Trust Fellows, was to help advocate to get that bill passed and to do storytelling and, you know, anecdotes from personal experience and to make them into, you know, very effective speakers and to testify and to just kind of, you know, talk to folks that are decision makers on getting that passed. But when it passed, within a month of the first fellowship last year getting selected, they were like, well, we have to figure out what we're going to do with these eight individuals now that we have. So they built out a workbook, basically a plan, and you can go and read it on the website, and it explains how to pursue Pell in each specific, in various states and what's going on. And our cohort this year is doing something very different. They're just kind of educating us significantly on the issue of Pell and higher education in prison, and just a lot of areas around higher education in general that we can use in our states and individual advocacy on this issue.
It sounds like this fellowship program really speaks to a lot of the other work that you do. You, of course, through the community, you advocate for prison reform. You are working to help people transition from life in prison. How does going through this fellowship allow you to do your work in a different way?
Yeah, it's really odd how over the course of my release, which is now going on close to maybe 28 months after serving 17 years in prison, that it's just been going into these different lanes instead of just sticking to one area. And that, you know, I never know how to describe what I do in the work because of that. As you said, I have, you know, various things we do in the organization, and now I'm getting significantly involved in the higher education space. I'm also a fellow at Marquette through their EPP program, which is a program teaching college programs and offering college credit to individuals that are in prison right now in Wisconsin. And creating a consortium of schools across the county to focus together on offering one degree instead of each school offering their own degree, which is very difficult to do for this population. So it's really cool how all these things have been coming together with these different experiences I've been having to be able to talk about this issue in a pretty well-rounded way, from higher education to reform, getting into some policy in the state this year with some experiences, just general reentry and narrative work that we do. So it has offered a very strong flavor, I think, to my ability to be of value in this space.
Now, as you look at your work moving forward, how do you plan to take this training with you moving into the future?
So in my work, I deal with a lot of folks that are currently incarcerated through our newsletter that has been going to half the prison population for about 2 years. And as of this month, will be going to virtually everyone in the prison population due to an expansion we have been given the opportunity to engage in. And with the information I'm getting from this fellowship and in my work in higher education, I can just be of more value to our readers and their loved ones who are trying to find out and navigate the higher education path while you're incarcerated or upon release. That comes into play in regards not just to education, but the help that you can get as an individual, as a student, you know, outside of the, you know, the academia world. And so I'm really happy to be able to have that information and those resources and that context to bring to the questions that people have and the articles and the news that we provide to people inside and their loved ones. And again, to those that are on release that I know, and I try to have a pretty active network of folks that I keep in touch with that I was incarcerated with, or that were incarcerated, and can reach out to get help from me however I can offer that.
All right. Well, Shannon, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Shannon Ross is a fellow of the Education Trust's Justice Fellows Policy Program. He's also the executive director of The Community, a local organization that helps people leaving incarceration. Ross spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can learn more about The Community and the work they do at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. The Third Ward has gone through many transformations in the city's history. Later in the show, we'll learn about some of the first people to inhabit the neighborhood. But first, we'll learn about one of Wisconsin's unique attractions, Cave of the Mounds, which was discovered by accident in 1939.
And lo and behold, when the dust settled, there was a big gaping hole where they expected this big pile of rubble to be. So they had accidentally discovered the cave by blowing up this 40-foot section of the cave ceiling.
We'll learn more coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is home to 50 state parks and 18 national natural landmarks. We've also got a village known as the Troll Capital of the World. With so many unexpected adventures and places to discover, why not plan your next vacation right here in our home state? We've teamed up with Travel Wisconsin for a monthly conversation where we bring you suggestions for great places to visit throughout the state. This month, we're talking about Cave of the Mounds. The general manager, Joe Klimczak, joins Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen, along with Amanda Weibel from Travel Wisconsin, to share more about this unique destination.
Cave of the Mounds is one of the state's national natural landmarks. So, Joe, to start, can you share a bit of history about the cave, starting with its discovery?
I sure will. Cave of the Mounds was discovered by accident in 1939, and when I say by accident, it was completely sealed up until that point in limestone rock. And there was a limestone quarry on the site of historic Brigham Farm here in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin. And the quarry workers on that fateful day were doing a routine, what they thought when they woke up that morning was going to be a routine quarry blast. So they drilled their holes to insert the dynamite, and they got some distance away and they set off the charge. And lo and behold, when the dust settled, there was a big gaping hole where they expected this big pile of rubble to be. So they had accidentally discovered the cave by blowing up this 40-foot section of the cave ceiling. And of course, the blasting stopped right on that day. And after waiting for a few hours to be sure things were safe and to kind of get up their courage, they lowered themselves down and discovered what we now call Cave of the Mounds.
And now it's open to the public. Tours are offered daily at the cave all year round. So what can people expect to see on a tour?
The cave is it's a wonder of Mother Nature. When visitors come to Cave of the Mounds, they enter the cave and go down about 10, 12 stairs onto this discovery platform where the cave was first, where this discovery blast occurred. And then they follow paved and lighted walkways with hand railings throughout the entire cave. So it's an adventurous experience, but it's a pretty soft adventure in that most people can do it. If they can handle some stairways, they can go down into Cave of the Mounds. And as they pass along the trail in the cave, they'll see wonderful crystal formations, calcite crystal formations that are made drip by drip over hundreds of thousands of years as water has been dripping into the cave. There are still pools underneath, underground pools. There's underground streams, and we even have a giant cephalopod fossil that can be found in the ceiling of the cave, part of that limestone sedimentary rock where the cave is found.
For some, the idea of going into a cave might be a little unsettling. There are people who might be afraid of tight spaces or the dark or bats, things like that. What would you tell people who might be a little hesitant about checking out the cave?
You know, I understand that hesitancy because I'm a fairly big person. And for me, going through tight spaces isn't really my favorite thing either. But Cave of the Mounds, the entrance room at the cave is 300 feet long by about 50 feet wide and 40 feet high. So my entire house could fit inside that entrance room of the cave. So really, people would be startled once they go down that entrance stairway to see how big some of the rooms inside the caverns are. And as a person goes through, it is lit throughout. You know, there's good lighting throughout to show off the features of the cave. And there's even a couple different passages so that if a person doesn't like a really tight space, and there's one spot where a person has to sort of go in that's a little tighter, but there's a path that goes around that as well. So it's only the people that want to go through the little tighter areas that have to. And I can say this, there have been many millions of people that have come to see Cave of the Mounds over the years, and we've never lost any of them. So it is it is adventurous. It is something that most people are able to do. And regarding bats, I can put you at ease there. There are no bats inside Cave of the Mounds. Going back to that discovery, the fact that it was completely sealed underground, there was no opening to the outside world, it means that we don't have a lot of those creatures that you might expect to find in the cave, the little flying crickets and fish or the bats that are in some caves. We don't have any of those in our cave. It's still maintained in that natural state, completely sealed to the outside world, except for the visitors that come in through our tours.
And the fossils, of course.
The fossils, of course, yes. And they've been still for many, many years.
You've got some events happening this month, including a history tour of the cave and a blacklight tour. So what can you tell me about that?
You know, the cave is so wonderful. And when I go down there, I could spend hours and hours. And of course, the cave tour is 1 hour. So we started a series of tours that offer different facets, so different ways to see the Cave of the Mounds. So one of them is this black light tour. One of the features of the calcite mineral that makes up the crystal formations inside the cave is that it does fluoresce and phosphoresce. So using a black light, one can see all different sorts of colors that you don't see under the normal lighting inside the cave. So we have some special high-powered black light flashlights that we give the people that come to visit on those tours and take them through and show them the cave in a different light. So we also have history tours then that will focus on the historical aspects of historic Brigham Farm. You know, I talked about the discovery in 1939, and it's got another interesting historic tie-in or facet, and that is that Ebenezer Brigham was the first permanent settler in southern Wisconsin. 1828, he had the first farm in Dane County, the first post office, he had an inn. It was on the old military road, and he settled directly above Cave of the Mounds, and he never knew that it was right there under his feet, because again, it was sealed to the outside world. So it was 111 years later that the cave was discovered accidentally in that quarry blast.
And there's more to see than just the cave. The grounds there are really beautiful. So what else could people or a family do on a visit?
Oh, there's just wonderful garden strolls in our rock terraces and perennial gardens. We also been working very hard on prairie and savanna restoration starting, 25 years ago. So those prairies and savannas are really well developed now, and it's just an explosion of blossoms in the summertime. And we have a couple miles of hiking trails through the woodland. Again, because of the old homestead character of this, there are some oak trees down in our oak woodland that are 200 plus years old, about 4 feet in diameter. So really giant oak trees that you could stroll among. And then we're opening this year a new prairie trail on some of the prairie restoration that's become more mature now. And from that trail, there's views for miles and miles, because we are located here in Blue Mounds, which is the high point of southern Wisconsin. So the views from here, even though it's an underground attraction, you wouldn't think of long views, but we're inside the East Blue Mound. So there's very long views. So there's these great hiking trails and all those things to do. But then there's also activities for the kids. We have a gemstone mine and fossil dig where kids can discover their very own treasure. We have bags of sand mixed up with crystals and fossils that they can use in our gem mining sluice and find their own treasures. Then we say it's a mystery of nature. The caves are always found directly below gift shops. And we have a gift shop which has a lot of treasures from Mother Nature, different crystal formations and fossils that are available to buy. And then we have historical exhibits above ground as well. So there really is a whole full day of activities to do while on site here at the Cave of the Mounds. And we are in a fantastic neighborhood in southwest Wisconsin, that there's not only, you know, this cave, the wonderful cave to come and see, but we have some state parks in the area. We have some other, charming little villages, other great attractions nearby.
One of those villages is Mount Horeb, not far from Cave of the Mounds. It's known as the troll capital of the world. Amanda, can you talk a little bit about Mount Horeb and its trolls?
This is such a fun, unexpected story, Becky. It all started in the mid-1970s when Open House Imports, which is a Scandinavian gift shop, put out troll statues on their lawn to draw in visitors. They caught the attention of everyone passing by, including the truckers, who would actually indicate their location over CB radio by referencing the trolls. When Highway 18-151 was rerouted in the 80s to bypass downtown Mount Horeb, village officials asked resident woodcarver Michael Feeney to craft more statues to continue to entice travelers to explore the community. And this love for trolls has only grown. Visitors can discover these wonderfully carved, whimsical statues at more than 20 different locations throughout the village today.
And there's more than just the trolls there in Mount Horeb. What else would you recommend people do when visiting the village?
Downtown Mount Horeb is a great place to do some shopping. So that business that kicked off the troll craze decades ago that I mentioned, Open House Imports, it's still around. So definitely stop in to find some unique Scandinavian gifts, including, of course, some troll-themed goods. Another shopping stop is Duluth Trading Company. So that apparel manufacturer is actually headquartered in Mount Horeb, and they operate a retail location on Main Street. So check out their great selection of apparel and other gear. And of course, you're going to be hungry after all of your shopping. You have great options right in Mount Horeb to eat. I definitely recommend checking out Shulin's Chocolate House. They have a fantastic breakfast and lunch menu. And of course, you have to get dessert. Shulin's makes delicious chocolates and a wide range of baked goods. And they have a really fun variety of flavored hot chocolates from around the world that are super fun. Another option is Brick Cider. They're also in Mount Horeb. They produce small batch hard ciders made from apples from local orchards, but they also have a great food menu that focuses on scratch-made meals that highlight other locally grown produce and locally made ingredients. Their menu changes with what's in season, so stop by soon if you want to check out their creamy, savory chicken and dumplings, or they have a really delicious sounding barbecue smoked mushroom sandwich topped with veggie slaw. They also have live music every week. They offer cidery tours, and they have other special events to check out. And Bricks is located right off of the Military Ridge State Trail, which is a 40-mile trail that connects Madison and Dodgeville. So it's a convenient stop after a walk or a bike ride on the trail.
If people are planning a whole trip out of this, they want to go to Cave of the Mounds, do some spelunking, they want to see some trolls, where are some places they could stay in the area?
There is so much to see and do around Cave of the Mounds and Mount Horeb that a trip is definitely worth a stay overnight. So a great option for families is the Deer Valley Lodge. This is just minutes away from Cave of the Mounds in the village of Barneveld. And no matter what season you're visiting Cave of the Mounds, Deer Valley Lodge has fun amenities year-round. They have a small indoor water park with a great activity pool, some fun water features for kids to play in, and body slides to zoom down. So great way to spend a few hours after visiting the cave. And in the warmer months, you can golf on Deer Valley Lodge's three courses. Their courses are each 9 holes, so you can make your golf outing as long or quick as time allows. And another option, Joe mentioned state parks nearby. So Blue Mountain State Park is a great option if you're looking to camp. And he mentioned also it's the highest point in southern Wisconsin. So great hikes with spectacular sweeping views. And this state park actually has a swimming pool and a splash pad open in the summer months. So great way to relax and enjoy the natural beauty of the park. And another highlight is its rustic accessible cabin available for rent that's designed to accommodate wheelchair users. It has a paved driveway and an accessible picnic table.
Hmm. I've been to a couple caves in different places around the country, and I can say that Cave of the Mounds is the coolest one that I have been in. So, Joe and Amanda, can you each share something you find special or unique about Cave of the Mounds?
Well, for me, you know, having been here for almost 25 years, to see the transformation, especially on the kids, but on people when they get to take a walk down inside the earth, it just strikes people in a way that you can't get on a screen. And it's one of these real experiences that just brings you back to something so elemental. So for me, it's really seeing how visitors react when they realize, like, wow, I really get to go down under the ground. And it's amazing what I saw down under there. So for me, it's the visitor reactions.
And Amanda?
Well, I have been one of those visitors with that awe-inspiring reaction. So it really, really is a special place. And I think just the vastness of the space that Joe mentioned, I don't think people think of that when you think of a cave, but there are just some really vast spaces. There are some narrow spaces too. So there's a great variety. It's so much fun to explore. And I also love that it's a year-round destination. You know, you don't have to think about the weather. It's a great opportunity to connect with nature in any season. So it's especially true for months like March, when maybe we don't have enough snow for winter activities, but it's not quite warm enough for that kayak or hiking trip that you want to take. So it's just a really fun option. And however you want to round out your trip to Cave of the Mounds, you can start your spring getaway at travelwisconsin.com.
Amanda and Joe, thank you so much for joining me for another Wandering Wisconsin.
Thank you, Becky.
Joe Klimczak is the general manager at Cave of the Mounds, and Amanda Weibel is the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen. Wandering Wisconsin is a partnership between WUWM and Travel Wisconsin. Each month, we help you plan a trip in our home state. Last month, we looked at the different events going on around maple syrup season, which is still in full swing right now. You can find more information about that and find past Wandering Wisconsin conversations at WUWM.com. Outside the Mitchell Park domes, there's a set of numbers and dates inlaid in the sidewalk. It may not look like much on a cloudy day, but if you stand in the right spot when the sun is out, it becomes a clock. We'll explain more in about 10 minutes. First, we'll learn about the history of Irish people coming to Milwaukee just ahead of St. Patrick's Day.
The most marshy area was the Third Ward. And because the Irish were right at the bottom of the economic ladder, they got the marshy land. It took several decades before Third Ward was totally filled in.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, a great time to celebrate the history of Milwaukee's Irish community, which helped create the city's Third Ward. But the city's early Irish community also faced many hardships. To learn more about this history, I'm joined by author Carl Bayer. When did Irish people, music, dance, and storytelling first come to the Third Ward?
At the time of the city's founding, actually, in the mid-1830s, after the Napoleonic Wars ended in Europe, many of the European countries disbanded their armies, and there was no longer a need to feed them, so the agricultural markets failed in Europe, and they converted much of the agricultural land to pasturage for sheep and started evicting the Irish peasants who had been growing their crops. This is the English landlords that did this. So during the next 30 years or so, about 1 million Irishmen emigrated from Ireland to North America. And by 1845, there were about 1,000 Irishmen in Milwaukee.
So what was it about Milwaukee that attracted Irish immigrants? And how did the Third Ward grow to be the largest Irish neighborhood in the city itself?
Well, they were looking for opportunities, and Milwaukee, being a new city, provided them with an opportunity. The city needed quite a few laborers, and there were a lot of tall bluffs in Milwaukee at the time. Along the Milwaukee River, along Lake Michigan, along the Menominee River, and those all had to be knocked down to make to have gently sloping hills. And much of the land at the base of these cliffs was marsh. So the fill went in to fill in marshes. The most marshy area was the Third Ward. And because the Irish were right at the bottom of the economic ladder, they got the marshy land. It took several decades before the Third Ward was totally filled in.
And the Third Ward, as you mentioned, was kind of a hard area to thrive in. And I'm hoping, can you explain some of the major events that led to, unfortunately, some of the highest fatality rates in the city?
Right, sure. Well, the cholera epidemic came in the late 1840s at a time when more Irish were coming to town because of the potato blight in Ireland. During that time, another 1 million to 1.5 million people died in Ireland, and another 2 million left Ireland. And so Milwaukee's Irish population by 1850 had grown to about 3,000 people. And well, because the cholera was spread by fecal matter in the water, and because the Irish lived right on Lake Michigan, a lot of the ships just threw their waste overboard into the lake. And so the Irish suffered mostly, more than any other ethnicity, from the cholera epidemic. Then 10 years later, there was a major disaster, the largest loss of life disaster in the city's history, with the sinking of the Lady Elgin, which was an Irish fundraiser. It took the Lady Elgin from Milwaukee to Chicago, but it never made it to Milwaukee. And 300 people drowned. Most of them were Irish, and most of them were from the Third Ward. So the people who were on the Lady Elgin were more or less the higher economic level of the Irish in Milwaukee, the saloon keepers, the boarding house keepers, professional people, although there weren't too many of those. So the Third Ward suffered economically for decades after that, because more or less the economic and political leaders, many of them, died on the Lady Elgin.
And it seems that the Third Ward was once again kind of a center for tragedy and affecting the Irish population the most. We had some major fires happen here. First, we can talk about is the Newhall House Fire in 1883.
Right, the Newhall House Fire. Up to that time, the largest loss of life in a hotel fire in the United States was 14 people, with the loss of 72 people in a Newhall House Fire. It was a major national catastrophe. There's many changes made throughout the country as far as fire escapes and burying wires under the ground to prevent problems that occurred in the Newhall House Fire. And over about half of the people who died in the Newhall House Fire were Irish women who lived in the Third Ward and worked at the Newhall House. So that was a major loss to the Irish community at that point. And then in 1892, the Third Ward Fire, the largest fire in the city's history, occurred, destroying parts or all of 20 blocks in the Third Ward, over 450 buildings, with 5 people dying. That was in 1892. And that pretty much started the exodus of the Irish from the Third Ward. The Italians began to move in, and the Irish moved out. So by 1910 or so, there were very few Irish left in the Third Ward, but for the first 70 years of the city's history, the Third Ward had been predominantly Irish.
So with the history of the Irish population in Milwaukee, it seems that it shows, one, the many difficulties they face for sustained periods of time, and also shows the struggle to adapt to American ways. What do you think is the importance of sharing a legacy that is not strictly success?
I guess it largely shows the difficulties that immigrants experience. First of all, the non-immigrants tend to isolate the immigrants, and the immigrants tend to isolate themselves by staying with people of their own culture. So it takes a long time, I think, for immigrants to really adjust to the new country. Sometimes 2 or 3 generations.
What do you think is most notable about the Irish immigrants' legacy here in Milwaukee, establishing themselves in the Third Ward, and then, as you mentioned, after the Third Ward Fire of 1892, then spreading out further into the greater southeastern Wisconsin area?
Well, just spreading out into the city, they came more in contact with other ethnic groups. There's a lot more intermarriage. It seems like today so many people in Milwaukee are Irish and German, or Irish and Polish, or Irish and something else. And being put in these other neighborhoods, they were no longer in an Irish community, so they became Milwaukeeans.
Well, Carl Baer, I want to thank you so much for joining me to share a little more about the history of the Irish in Milwaukee's Third Ward.
Great, I appreciate it.
Carl Baer is the author of From the Emerald Isle to the Cream City, History of the Irish in Milwaukee. We spoke last August.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The Mitchell Park Domes are a beloved Milwaukee landmark. People flock to the botanical gardens every season of the year. But if you come on a weekend, you may find yourself waiting in a long line, stretching down the sidewalk and over one of the dome's lesser-known features. A set of numbers that form a half circle around a center block that lists each month of the year. That's where I met up with listener Kate Collins, who wanted to know more about this mysterious inlay.
Oh, hi, you're Joy. Yep. I'm Kate.
So, what is it?
Strictly speaking, they have a proper name of analemmatic sundials, which are at ground level and use anything vertical, whether that be a vertical rod or a person, it's the shadow of that upright thing that tells the time.
That's Douglas Hunt, the former owner of Modern Sun Clocks in Scotland, and the man who created the layout of the sundial in front of the domes. The type of sundial most people are familiar with are flat and circular, and have an upright triangle sticking up on top. That's known as the gnomon, and its shadow is what indicates the time of day. The clock in front of the domes has two sets of numbers, one for daylight saving time and one for standard time. And it doesn't have a traditional gnomon. Instead, the person interacting with the dial becomes the gnomon. That's key to how an analemmatic sundial works.
Unlike normal sundials that just have a fixed gnomon, analemmatic sundials require that upright thing, but it has to be moved along a scale of months in the middle to compensate for the changing seasons.
That scale is known as the zodiac walkway, and it's necessary to getting the right time on the clock. The term analemmatic refers to the analemma, a diagram of how the sun's movement changes in relation to a fixed point on Earth. Basically, as the seasons change, our distance to the sun also changes. So if a person wants to figure out what time it is, they have to stand on the right month on the zodiac walkway. Paula Zamiatowski, a naturalist educator for the domes, demonstrates.
The very center of each block is the exact date. So that's what you do. You actually go on. Where are we? Where's my march? Here we are. We stand here and we're going to pretend this is a beautiful sunny day. And you put your arms up and I become the gnomon. It doesn't matter if you're short or if you're tall. You still get the shadow where you need it.
As you might guess, all of that takes a lot of math. Figuring out which way the clock needs to face, how far apart the numbers need to be, even how big each of the month's tiles have to be in order to get the right time. That's where Douglas Hunt comes in. His company created layouts based on these complicated formulas for places around the world.
So all we needed to know basically was the address of its intended location. And that meant finding the specific latitude and longitude for that location. Because every single layout anywhere in the world is absolutely unique.
For Paula, this sundial holds a special meaning. When she first started working at the domes, the dial was painted on the sidewalk by her late predecessor, Becky Lay, who first came up with the idea to put in the clock.
Back in 1998, Becky got all these calculations and painted one on a little further to the front. Then a few years later, she had to have a heart transplant. So I took over painting every year and touching it up. And then when the designs for this plaza came about, no one wanted to part with this.
Now it's a permanent part of the domes. So the next time you find yourself waiting in a line on a bright sunny day, you won't need your phone to check the time. Just look down. I'm Joy Powers for Bubbler Talk.
Support for this season of Bubbler Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What do you want to know about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
You can hear Bubbler Talk every Thursday on Lake Effect, and you can find more information about the sundial at the Mitchell Park Domes tomorrow on wuwm.com. There you'll also find all of our previous Bubbler Talk stories. And Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn, Robert Larry, and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Lena Tran, Kobe Brown, and Chuck Kornbach from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Blair Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. There are over 30 Marvel films, many of them with interweaving storylines and characters. Join us again on Monday at noon for a look at the politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.